Tom Ashbrook, and this is a special edition of On Point, recorded in front of a live audience in Washington, D.C. Today, the nation's capital may be the perfect place to talk disruption. And I hosted a panel at the PRPD, the Public Radio Content Conference in Washington, on the digital disruption of news and the media. My guests, Jeremy Gilbert, Director of Strategic Initiatives at the Washington Post, Matt Thompson, Deputy Editor of the Atlantic.com, Allison Rocky, Director of Programming at Vox, and Maribel Perez Wadsworth, Senior Vice President and Chief Transformation Officer at Gannett.
Thank you very much, and it's great to be here. We're talking digital disruption, and I just have to take a moment to note that we're talking about digital disruption at a time when in this city and around this country we have disruption going on a scale that, as big as this is, almost dwarfs it. The conversation, I know you've talked a lot about it at this conference already, but what's happening, what happened in Charlottesville, what's happening around the country, what's happening on the airwaves right now is just electric. And it just strikes me that we have to always remember what this country actually is now, where we've come now. In my own family, it strikes each of us, but in my own family, I have Christian, Jew, Muslim, Latino, Asian, Black, gay, and straight. These are just in my family. So we can't deny this, and the disruption that we need here, let's make it a disruption that goes in a great and positive direction, led by great news organizations, not fake news, but great news organizations like those represented right here and on this stage. I hope we can all say yes to that. We know, we were talking before we began here, that we've had these conversations now about digital disruption for 20 years, 25 years. It's been going on a long time, but the field keeps changing. And it is not going to stop. Here's my question, just to start out of the gate. When you look across the whole field of news media and what's happening now, I mean, I'm reading here where, what is it, Google and Facebook, just between the two of them, now take in more than half of all mobile advertising revenue. We know this is where it's going. The two companies' ad revenue, just those two, is growing faster than the rest of the, all the rest of the market combined. So this is intimidating for any news organization. When you look across the whole field of news media and who's doing what, whether by name or by profile, who's going to win? Maribel?
Goodness, who's going to win? I mean, I don't think it's really about any one player winning. What you're talking about with Facebook and Google is a very real thing, and they are taking in all these digital dollars. They also don't have the burden of paying for any of the content that they serve up. So really, I think it's incumbent on us as an industry, whether you know across the medium, to stand up for that and to stop renting platforms. I should say.
Stop renting platforms. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is, you know, again, the value we create is so tremendous, and we live in a very distributed content world, but the so-called partnerships are quite uneven. When you, you're in a relationship with Facebook or Google or any of the others, and at the end of the day, you're providing a lot more value in many cases than you're getting back directly, and you're losing your direct relationship with your audience. And I think that's really, really important and something that we have to pay a lot of attention to.
In other words, go right to the audience yourself. Don't be intermediated. But they're so big.
It's one thing to be intermediated in terms of sharing your content socially, making sure that you're creating awareness about the content you're creating, you're connecting with the audience. But don't lose your direct relationship with them. Don't have them simply live on those platforms. And I think that's something that we've all sort of rushed to, and I think we need to spend a little time thinking about.
Jeremy, by institution or by profile, who's going to win in this highly disruptive and evolving age?
I have to say, I think our audience are the people who are winning. Our audience are winning because they have choice in how they consume our information. They just didn't have that before. Whether it's a radio station that you tune into or especially a printed newspaper, you got the newspaper you got, and you had this relationship that was very locked in. Our audience is actually much better served by this disruption that we talked about, by all the ways the information can reach. So the question for us as people who create content is how do we afford to create content and serve it to the audience in the way that the audience clearly wants it? The challenge that Maribel speaks about is absolutely real. That said, our youngest consumers don't seem to be interested in having a one media source relationship. And that's okay. So the question is, how can we afford to pay for the high quality journalism that is absolutely at its most critical? I would argue, even 2 years ago, the audience wouldn't have said credibility is one of the most important things they seek in news. Today, whichever side you're on, whether news is fake or real, most people are talking about the validity of news. They don't agree necessarily on what is real, but they care. So the question is, if they care about valid and credible news sources, how can you find a way to raise the revenue that you need to do? And realistically, right now, there are only two effective ways. One is the sort of membership model most familiar to you. We would, at the Post, describe it as a subscription relationship. And the other is underwriting and advertising. Those models are both in very different ways affected by what Maribel was talking about. If you subscribe, for example, to a news service or become a member of a news service through Facebook, that's very different than a direct relationship. So the same goes for when we talk about Google and Facebook controlling most of the advertising dollars. Realistically, a large portion of those advertising dollars are still coming through to media. But we don't control the relationship with advertisers any more than we control the relationship with the audience. I do think we need to find ways to create value for the audience that is so significant that they're willing to pay us directly. And I'm not sure we have.
Who's winning?
I think the people that are going to come out on top, the people that are going to win, are going to be the ones who look at these new platforms and all of these places to meet our audience as an incredible opportunity. You know, what is the way that we can give our audience a valuable experience when they're in all of these other places? I think oftentimes they're viewed as means to bring the audience back to our website or something like that. But I think if we're focusing on how can we be providing incredible value to our audience, how can we create content that is uniquely for that platform that our audience is going to consume and they're going to love, that's how we're going to get loyalty. And that's the thing that NPR has done for years and years and years that has been incredibly valuable and is why they're such an important brand today. People are proud to be NPR listeners. And I think the way we do that today, especially from a digital perspective, is creating content like that that's relatable, that is authentic, that people see, they get a tremendous value in, and then they can become valuable, loyal customers of your brand. And I think that's the way you win.
You all have these amazing titles. I mean, you're director of Chief Transformation Officer. Oh, that's fantastic. And strategic initiatives under Jeff Bezos. I mean, that's intimidating just to sit in that chair. You're director of programming in this world that doesn't have traditional boundaries around it. I wish you would each, and I'll start with you, Allison, describe exactly what do you actually do? It's great. What's your job?
I hope my mom is watching.
Mom, this is for you. Allison's mom.
Yes, so I'm the director of programming at Vox.com, which is one of the 9 brands under the Vox Media umbrella. And when I started at Vox 3 years ago, it was the week before we launched our website, and my job at that point was engagement editor, which really meant I did everything, write the tweets, write the Facebook posts, you know, in the weeds of it. And as we've grown in just 3 years, the opportunities for where we're meeting our audience and how we're growing our audience are just changing every day.
Describe that growth.
Sure. So 3 years ago, we weren't going to have a strong SEO to begin with. We didn't have brand recognition when we launched. We had to go get our audience on social media. That was the way you grew an audience in 2014. Absolutely, no question. But as we've grown and the industry has grown in those 3 years, now there are opportunities across so many more platforms for us to have a meaningful interaction with our audience or provide them a valuable service where they are. And so it's my job to oversee those new initiatives, make the decisions of which ones we go after and which ones we don't.
What does that mean? Give us some examples. What strings are you pulling? What channels are you pursuing?
Right now we're pursuing audio a lot. We think the opportunity...
Hello.
We think the opportunity to, you know, really increase our loyalty with our audience is huge. In audio right now, I think everyone in this room can relate to not wanting to spend as much time in front of a screen during the day. And there's just incredible storytelling opportunities. So audio is one we're pursuing really big. But then we are on, you know, the many other platforms, between whether it's Facebook Instant Articles and Apple News and Google Newsstand, and I would hate to leave any of them out.
So your job with all those is?
My job is to oversee the content we're creating on those platforms, making sure that it is true to the Vox brand, that it is meeting our editorial standards, and that it's also serving our audience. We talk a lot about being an audience-focused brand, and so that's a big part of the role there,
too.
We're
going to come back to you and audio, maybe to all of you. God knows the whole, everybody's coming at it. Jeremy, your job. Okay, that's big. What is it, actually?
What do I do? You know, one of the things that's really interesting about my job is that it operates on a couple of levels if I'm doing it correctly. I would argue that I have one of the most fun jobs in the newsroom, unless you're going to be David Farenthold. But what I try to do is look for opportunities, either partnerships or areas that are underserved, both in terms of where we can distribute our content, what kinds of stories we can tell, and especially what kinds of technologies can we work with. Sometimes it's hardware, sometimes it's software, often things created outside the post, sometimes things that we have been developing in-house. I try to then chart what the potential strategic direction looks like for the post. What would we have to invest? What would we potentially reap? What are the consequences if it goes wrong? Then the part that's really fun for me is I get to do a lot of the first round of experimentation. So I spend my time putting together ad hoc teams within the newsroom and across the company, often involving technology and sometimes the revenue side, to build out our first version of a lot of these ideas and partnerships and get to try them. If they work, which is great, then someone else gets to own them. If they don't work, then I have to make the tough decision. Was it the wrong bet, or should we try again in a slightly different way? The other thing that I spend a lot of my time doing is trying to knit together the newsroom and both the subscription and revenue sides, the advertising side especially of our business, where we can say, what are the things that we're investing in editorially, and is there a possibility to tie revenue to those things? Not have the revenue side drive what happens in the newsroom. Marty Baron would never let that happen. But when we do great journalism, shouldn't we try to find a way to make money to support more great journalism?
So Jeff Bezos buys it in 2013, the Washington Post, for $250 million. He comes in very quickly and says, the fast fail strategy is among the things I think he said he wanted to pursue.
Yes.
You're the tip of that spear. Like, go out and try and then call it success or failure?
Absolutely. So the thing, we the Post leadership, meets with Bezos by phone usually every other week. And what we do is we throw out
Marty
ideas.
Marty Baron, you?
I mean, sometimes me when I have a project. Marty always, Shailesh Prakash, our CIO, our publisher, the head of revenue. And the idea there, it's true to everything you've read about Amazon. We write memos. Jeff reads the memo in advance. Often he'll say, I've read the memo. Do you have anything else you want to tell me? Otherwise, I have questions. And he always finds the thing that you did not prepare. No matter how hard you prepared, the thing that seemed least consequential is the first thing he asks. But what he does in this sort of contrarian way is really challenge our ideas. And he has done two things that way. One, he has made us less risk averse. He has made us more willing to take risks because he asks us about one-way doors. He says, is this a one-way door? So, for example, if the Post were to have said 3 years ago, we are going to expand our print footprint like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and others. We are going to set up agreements with all of Maribel's local affiliates and we're going to print their sites. We'll sign a 5-year contract. That's a one-way door. If it stops working after month one, we have 4 years and 11 months to go and we have to eat all of that cost. On the other hand, most of the things we try digitally, if it doesn't work, we lost some time, we lost some energy, and we just stopped doing it. And because of that, the consequences of making mistakes are slightly lower, and therefore we're more willing to try things. And some of those things have really worked.
Does it mean he doesn't want one-way doors?
He does not want one-way doors unless we are so convinced that those one-way doors will work. For example, he has fairly completely and totally believed that more reporting equals more audience. Hiring reporters is a one-way door. We are not going to hire reporters to cover new coverage areas, decide those coverage areas don't work, and jettison those reporters. So those are definitely one-way doors. Investing in our technologists, investing in our journalists, sure. Are we likely to build lots more printing plants? Probably not. Those would be one-way doors that might have less upside.
More reporting without more reporters. We'll come back to that. Mirabel, what's your job? That's the grandest title of all.
I know. It's kind of crazy.
I feel transformed just sitting next to you.
Yeah, right.
Something is stirring in me, Mirabel.
If only a few more people did. Yeah. So I am responsible for our content, product, and strategy divisions at Gannett. And so what does that mean? I mean, any given day, my job sounds a lot like Allison and Jeremy's. Really focused, first on our audiences. We know that we serve different audiences. It's not a one-size-fits-all. We know we need to be on a lot of different platforms. We need to be experimenting in storytelling forms. We need to make sure we're doing the right content and not just a one-size-fits-all kind of pursuit of our journalism and content, broadly speaking. We have to spend a lot of time with external partners, both on the technology side and the social platforms, et cetera, and to really get to a place where we have a signature brand expression. People come to recognize USA Today and our local properties. We have 109 local news properties, so we're very similar, obviously, to NPR. So the experiment, our way to the answer, is one of our key mantras. We spend a lot of time actually celebrating the things that didn't work. So we have my innovation lab team, for example. Mm-hmm. Every month we'll put together a newsletter that goes out to all 18,000 employees, and in it always will be a, hooray, this didn't work, because we're excited that we're actually trying these things. And at times it's that learning that's much more critical.
How do you do that? Yes, it didn't work.
Yes, yeah. I mean, absolutely.
How do you take the learning to do that?
Well, you have to know what it is you're trying to accomplish, and you have to have some clear success metrics, and from that you can determine fairly easily, did this work, did it not? To Jeremy's point, is it worth another turn, another iteration, or is it just wrong thing, good idea, but yeah, just doesn't work, and set it aside. And we were once a company that was admittedly probably too slow to make some bets, too slow to take on the experiments. There was a concern that if something didn't work, then it was, failure, all caps. And now I think that, that notion of celebrating the things that didn't work has really taken on and is leading people to feel, a lot more empowered to try things. And some of those things have really worked.
Let's mix it up a little bit here. Are you, Lord of Transformation for Gannett, intimidated by having Jeff Bezos behind the post competition?
No, I'm delighted to have Jeff in the mix. I think that more people willing to invest in quality journalism in this country is a really good thing. So I applaud Jeff. I applaud him for stepping up. And
he's eaten every retailer in the country. Will he eat you too, ultimately?
No, he'd spit me out.
Okay. We'll take that. I want to ask each of you to describe in gritty terms, because these are people who like get it done at the, they've got institutions which are very important in their communities and beyond, and they're working just like you, but right at that level to get it done. Allison, give us some examples of what you consider some of the most important changes. We're talking disruption. That means change. That means significant change.
Yep.
But sometimes significant change can be small. Sometimes they're very grand. What do you see in the years that you've been doing this now as the most important changes that you've brought to the table in your organization?
I would say the most important change, or the one thing I would want to walk away with from here, is the idea that we should be creating valuable content on the platforms they're on. I think we really, as an industry, are still a little stuck in that we are pushing people back to a different experience, that the core of what we do is the only thing that's important.
I mean, for example, a print product somewhere.
A print product or a radio show.
The website.
Exactly. And I really think that the shift that we need to be making is how are we providing a valuable experience, not providing a teaser or this or that, mm-hmm. but how can we create an experience on that platform where someone's with us that makes them... That good experience is going to snowball.
Make that real. Give us some example. What do you mean?
I think, we could go in so many directions, but maybe let's look at Instagram. Instagram is a platform that starts as photos. I think a lot of organizations don't really know what to do with it, you know, unless you're, I mean, one of the Vox Media sites, Eater, is literally a site about food. So they have great content on Instagram. It's just made for that. It's very easy to like. But what is the way you can serve the audience when you're on that platform? We've started doing a weekend post that is called The Week Explained, which is very much in brand for us. And it is a photo and a couple sentences of the top stories of the week. We don't think that that fully gives you the explanation that we want to. That's not the entirety of what our brand is about. But it works on that platform, and it piques your interest enough that then you're going to want to have another experience somewhere.
So there's a meal for you right there before you go on.
Absolutely.
Facebook, what's your counterpart strategy there? How do you make that valuable at where it is?
Facebook's video. Facebook is all video right now. I mean, we post a lot of important stories. We have some really powerful Facebook communities. One of our podcasts has a community on Facebook that it's a podcast called The Weeds, where people are really, really interested in policy details. And we have over 8,000 people that have joined this Facebook community to want to talk about nerdy policy details. So I think there's a lot of opportunities to give different parts of your audience what they want, what really serves them, what kind of the kinds of things that feel a part of their identity are the things that I think we really want to focus on. But
what do you mean by that?
I think sometimes with social media, it's easy to forget that people are expressing themselves constantly. I think there's good and there's bad to that, but people on social media, they want to look smart, they want to look interesting, whatever their kind of identity of the person they want to portray in the digital world, that's what they're looking to do with our content.
So you're giving them shareable content that will reflect back on them when they distribute it to their
Absolutely.
Circle?
Absolutely.
So you help them shape an identity with
And to feel a part of a group at the same time. You know, with this community of Weeds listeners, within days of the group starting, somebody put up a poll. They're like, who are all these people? Who listens to this weird policy podcast with me? You know, who gets really excited about these details? And they put up a poll just of people's professions. And it was just so interesting that these people want to feel
part of something.
Part of something.
Here's
yeah.
who we are.
Exactly.
And what does your brand reflect on them? If they want to be associated with Vox, what do yeah. you hope that means?
I really hope it means that they are curious about the world around them, that they have, they tend to be busy people with jobs and lives, but they, even if they're not an expert on an area, they want to feel informed and they want to be knowledgeable and they want to help other people also be informed.
Twitter, 140 characters. How do you provide content there that is not just a come on to go somewhere else?
Yeah.
Or do you?
We do. It is challenging. It is. We're seeing a big growth in video also on Twitter right now. Imagery and infographics work really well. And then as you see with a lot of people doing threaded tweet stories, that's another nice way to give a little bit more context
As we go through these, your questions may come to mind. We will take them in before this hour is out. So their microphones will come to them later. But if you have them, note them and we'll come to you. Jeremy, the most important changes, innovations that you've made so far?
I think absolutely. It's what has changed for the roles of reporters and editors in our newsroom. That there is no doubt in my mind, we ask not just more, but very different things of our reporters and assigning editors. It's really critical that our reporters and assigning editors understand what their individual strategies are. Not maybe to the reporter level yet, but certainly to the assigning editor. The assigning editor who is thinking about what are we covering in terms of a particular topic? They can't just say, we will do the stories and our audiences will listen, read, watch. They have to instead say, who are we trying to reach? What do they need? And how are we going to serve them most effectively? And we are asking the reporters and editors to think not just about how they produce one kind of story, but how they produce stories for all of the potential platforms and channels that would reach that audience. And that really changes things. It changes things dramatically to say instead, it's not just our newsroom that needs to have a strategy and audience in mind, but rather everyone who covers a vertical or topic needs to be thinking about who they are serving and how they are going to serve them. Our reporters now produce their own stories. It doesn't mean they don't have edits. It doesn't mean that they're not copy edited. But it does mean because they know the information they gather better than everyone else, that they should pick the share image. That they should
help
us.
They should pick
the what, sorry? The share image, for example, on a story. They should pick what the visualization that goes with it. They should work with the video team if they're creating videos. And then they are the first step in the distribution process. That if we have several hundred reporters who are publishing hundreds of stories a day, our core social accounts, Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, etc., we are not going the Washington Post to be able to share every compelling story we have. And honestly, if you care about a topic, whether it's fashion or national security, we are going to serve you better if we connect you with the reporter and editor who are the experts in that area than we are if we ask you to follow the main account and hope that the topic you care about is served. And so, as much as we can, we need to make the individual members of our reporting team be the people who distribute our stories. And that really changes the relationship you have, not just with the stories that you write and edit, but also with your sources and the way you think about what stories you should cover.
This is really interesting. Can we back up? And I still didn't hear it. Did you say they decide the share mix?
Image. So,
image.
For example.
Image.
As
oh, just, the, just the photo that goes with
well, it. But I would argue it's not just the photo because if... So we went, for example, through a... Transformation is very grand. It fits Maribel's title and not what I'm about to
Maribel's
describe.
Maribel's very grand. Just
Maribel's very grand. No, but... You know, initially the Post would share stories on Facebook, and if you didn't bother to do anything, it would be a headline and some text, and we'd be happy that you did your job and put something on Facebook. Then we got to a point where we said, well, actually, we really shouldn't share anything on Facebook if it does not have an image associated with it. The kinds of success metrics that we have suggest that it's wildly different if there's any image than no image. Okay. So we made some sort of generic thing. I think you probably have seen it at some point. It was like the Lincoln Memorial, and it was on virtually every Post story because most employees didn't bother, didn't understand why that was important. Now we're at a point where our reporters understand that if they write great stories, if they do great journalism, it is a mistake to not try to let people look at it. And that means choosing an image that is not just compelling, but actually relevant to the story they have.
Informative, something...
I mean, hopefully informative, but what we don't want to do is clickbait. We don't want to play a game that says, we will convince you to click on this story, and then you will be immediately let down by what you find.
Well, they were putting up irrelevant pictures. I don't know, like...
Not deliberately.
Beyonce, just to...
No, but they certainly were saying... The most important thing I do is go find news, which is still true.
Yeah.
The second most important thing I do is write up the story. The absolutely least important thing I do is pick an image associated with that story. And then the truth is, if you really did your job on the first two points, no one's going to see it. So you might as well spend a little bit more time thinking
yeah.
about how your audience is going to find your journalism by picking an image that's captivating, picking an image that's relevant, picking an image that actually delivers on the promise of what your story has. And so you should think about how you're going to share it. You should think about the share language. You should think about who is most likely to read your story and speak to them in their voice. Not necessarily changing your reading level, not speaking down to them, but acknowledging what they might be interested in because different audiences need different things.
There's so many pieces I love here. Share language. I guess I know what you mean, but how do you get across to your reporters what that is?
Well, so we tried a bunch of different training strategies. The thing that works most effectively...
Well, define it first and then...
Oh, sure, sure. So what I mean is when you write a story, most of our stories are still written. A lot of them are visual or audio, video, but most stories are written. So when you take that piece of text-based, primarily, journalism, and you want to put it on Facebook, you can choose what the headline effectively is on the post. You can choose what the description is. You can choose what image is associated with it or video. And so you have that, but it doesn't have to be the same as what you put on Twitter. It doesn't have to be the same as how you describe it on Snapchat. And so you can have different language for all the different platforms you're going to distribute the story on. And you may want to think based on who your audience is. So, for example, the journalists on our financial team are thinking a lot about how conversations start on LinkedIn. And that's very different than breaking news, which works so effectively on Twitter.
Because financial people tend to be busy on LinkedIn?
I mean, if you think about, and many of you, you may not want to admit it, but are on LinkedIn for no other reason than your personal career,
nah.
Then you want to think about what you share there is very much about how you advance your own career interests. You're not trying to be provocative necessarily. You're not trying to be as funny and clever as you might be where, you know, Twitter demands hopefully, or people aspire to, being witty on Twitter or on Facebook. You really want to sort of show your personal compassion. On LinkedIn, you want to show that as a career-minded individual, you know what information might be interested to other career-minded individuals.
You're sharp. You're on top of it.
So it demands very different approaches. And so we tried when working with our reporters to say, look, let us show you cases of where this worked for different types of stories. And then we took members of our audience team and embedded them in the reporting teams and had them spend a week or two with reporters and help them craft the language, help them evaluate whether things were successful, and even help them understand what metrics might actually matter.
So they really are producers. Who captures the image that they're selecting? Are they photographers too?
Well, it depends. I mean, a lot. We are lucky enough to have a fairly healthy and robust photography team. So we do a lot of original photography. We have access to a number of different wire services. We use some stock imagery.
You said they decide. You want them to decide who am I trying to reach? Now the traditional model is everybody. So what do you mean?
The traditional model was never everybody.
Well,
I mean, you might say that in your newsroom, just as we said that with the newspaper, but everybody was a bit of a joke. I mean, we would talk in print very much about, oh, well, sports readers do this, and news readers do that. And when Ben Bradley back in the 60s invented the style section, it was to serve a wholly different, often gender-selected audience. And we would claim that because everyone got the same product, everyone read all the stories. If you've ever been to a focus group, there's almost no focus group where the people in the focus group don't say, oh, we love everything you do, because we want to please each other. That doesn't actually mean we read, watch, listen to everything we do. We don't. So let's acknowledge who our actual audience for our specific journalism is, and then we can better serve them. It could be demographic. It could be interest-based. It could be geographic. I mean, especially, for example, in Maribel's newsrooms, some of them are very geographically based. Mm-hmm. Those are real audiences, and you speak to them differently than you would if you were trying to reach everyone. When you reach everyone, you effectively only speak for yourself.
Whew. There's one to chat down. Maribel, most important changes, innovations you've made specifically.
So I'll speak to, I want to piggyback on what Jeremy was just talking about, because really what he's describing is a concept that's been very true in our world as well, which is really the concept of the journalist as a marketer. And really having that marketer mindset where you start with the audience, you understand what their needs are, you understand how best to connect with them, where to connect with them, what's unique about those various channels so that you can actually speak in relatable ways and share your content in relatable ways on those different channels. All of that is important. It's table stakes. It's the way we have to do business today. That said, what I think a little bit of the danger of the ways in which we evolved and the pace of change that we've experienced is that while we weren't writing for everybody, we were trying to do all things. And that's just not a winning strategy in the long run. And one of the things that I have been, that our organization is really driving at now, is a pendulum swing slightly in a different direction, which is to focus on specialization. Not everybody is going to be good at all things. Not everybody is going to really understand the nuances between Snapchat and Facebook, or to tell great video stories and great audio stories and write an amazing, compelling newsletter. And yet we have to do all of these things. And so what we really need is expertise on the various platforms. We need expertise in the various storytelling forms. And we need to infuse that back into our news organizations, I think, in order to get to a much more sophisticated place, a place that hopefully will be much more successful.
How are you driving that?
So we're very focused on building the skills and capabilities. We're hiring different types of people. We're hiring people who are, you know, much more expert in audio, for example. I mean, a growing platform, a very important platform. Whether that's, you know, the podcast world or the world of, you know, voice activated technologies like Google Home or Alexa. We are very focused on video capabilities, both on the technology side and working with various partners there, but also in having great video storytellers in our newsrooms and shifting resources to make sure that we're adequately powering that. I think another thing Jeremy said is really important, and it's really at the end of the day, you know, that reporter, you know, that expertise, those individual brands are really key. That's true for those people who write stories. That's also going to be true for the personalities behind some of our signature experiences, whether that's in audio and video and newsletters, et cetera.
So on the local front, I mean, you've always been local, but you've talked a lot about driving that. How are you? You've got USA Today up here. You've got your traditional properties there. How are you pushing toward the local front further in this age?
It's less push and more, I think, you know, coming in both directions. I mean, we are fundamentally a local company. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of the value that we bring, I think, to the equation, which is being in those communities and those relationships, being able to raise up important issues from communities across the country to the national consciousness with, you know, thankfully with the benefit of the USA Today brand. But that is key to that. But we're finding that's also, you know, quite the innovation sandbox for us when you're in 109 newsrooms mm-hmm. Across the country, and people have great ideas about how to tell stories differently, how to use a platform differently, and we can learn from that in small ways in local markets, and then ultimately hopefully scale those experiments.
What's happening to the economics of your local presence? Are you succeeding in sustaining your reporting capacity there? Are you having to cut it back? Does the local still really work? Economically,
local definitely works. It's the vast majority of our business for sure, and we still are pretty much universally the main local news source in all these markets. We enjoy the biggest newsrooms, for example, on the revenue side. We have the largest sales teams in any given community. We certainly keep a lot of investment there. There's no question that there's a ton of change happening. There's a lot of pressure, certainly on the print side of the business. But it's really about making sure your resources are where they need to be to support your
communities. What about your raw reporting horsepower at the local level? We read about cutbacks everywhere, you know, from the very biggest news organizations on down. What's happening at the local level with Gannett? What's happened over the last 10 years?
There's no question that our newsrooms have, definitely become smaller over time. That comes in a lot of different ways. We have centralized some functions like print design and things mm-hmm. like that have led to slightly smaller operations. I do think though that the quality has improved through greater specialization, again, you know, being focused on that. I think we're going to see that over time, but at the end of the day, today we still as a company employ, 3,500 journalists. Mm-hmm. And reach an audience that's over 100 million strong. So mm-hmm. I think that what we need is a focus. We're not all things to all people. Still today, a lot of our newsrooms, not just us, but across the industry, are doing a lot of content, chasing a lot of stories that are not necessarily in line with what their readers' needs are and what people choose to come to us for. People come to USA Today for different reasons that they come to the Post. And we need to own those differences. We need to feel good about those differences, and we need to make sure we're serving our audiences in our own unique way. Same with Vox. We are all very different, sitting here on the stage.
But where do you see wastage in reporting effort?
I wish I could tell you there's like one universal.
Kind of thing? I mean, you raised it. What are you talking about?
So for example, at the local level, we probably spend a lot more time than we need to chasing the latest small crime story or doing day-to-day coverage at City Hall, for example. I mean, we need more issues-based coverage. In Palm Springs, for example, one of our markets, climate, the environment are huge topics. And so that's where we'll throw our reporting firepower. That's where we'll throw a team to really talk about the issues of drought, of climate change, et cetera, in California. In Phoenix, Arizona, another one of our big markets, issues of immigration. Of course, this is true in a lot of communities, but certainly in Phoenix, it's ground zero for a lot of our important immigration stories. We throw our reporting firepower there. It's really about the things that we want to be known for versus trying to cover all things.
Who picks up the sort of civic responsibility then of letting the local community know these crimes are happening in this neighborhood or this is going on at City Hall? If you're tamping that down, who picks it up?
Well, I think it's not that we're going to take our eye off the ball. I think we're still paying attention to that, but we don't have to write a story about everything just because it happened. And I think that's the big difference. It's keeping an eye on, you know, what are the trends? What are the things truly worth investing, you know, reporting time into? It's valuable time. And so are you really focused on the right things, or are you just simply, you know, throwing a lot of things to the wind? And I think that we have to pay attention. We have to pay attention to our metrics. What stories do resonate? You know, see the trends in that and put more reporting firepower there.
Jeremy, how do you think about that issue? There's a lot to be covered. The traditional press was seen as responsible for bringing us the whole kit and caboodle. Now, you know, Maribel says, well, look at issues that will drive the metrics. You've looked even at automated news reportage. Is that where some of this local reporting comes from? How does your automated thing work? Are you in like an army of bots now?
No. So, for example, we were looking at the 2016 election at congressional, at the House level, the Senate level, gubernatorial races. Traditionally speaking, the Washington Post had covered Virginia, Maryland, maybe a little bit of Delaware, Pennsylvania, and the district. And we had said, we are going to cover those areas on a local level, and then we'll cover the most interesting national races. So in 2012, that meant we covered about 15% of all of the races. Our audience was more than three times as big. We had gone from digitally about 30 million to 100 million people by the time the election was coming in a given month, according to ComScore. And so we knew we needed to cover things very differently, because if you live in a House district, even if you have an incumbent, maybe even if they're unopposed, that election matters to you. You should know who won that race and by what margin. So we wanted to cover all the races. Would it have been a good use of Washington Post journalists? We have a large number of reporters, I don't mean to say otherwise, but not enough that we can cover about 500 races. No, it would have been crazy to cover that instead of doing analysis, instead of doing interviews, instead of doing other things. So what did we do? We used a number of different data sources. We used VoteSmart and the AP election feed. We looked at historical results. We looked at census data. And we were able to cover in real time all of the House districts, for example, by relying on a system that evaluated the data coming in and wrote stories coming out of it. Can that help us cover a bunch of different local issues? Yes. Are we doing that to replace any of our human journalists? Absolutely not. Are we hopefully freeing up humans to stop writing rote and mundane stories? Yes, I hope so.
You call it Helio? Or
Heliograph.
Heliograph. So, and it's a kind of AI, or you've got some ready-made phrases that you drop in with the numbers then that are appropriate to that district, and
so
you've got a story.
So the system analyzes the numbers. So, for example, the vote totals as they came in every 60 to 90 seconds, or the high school football scores as they come in. And it looks at the trends it sees, it compares it to historical data, it compares it to other like events, so other House districts or other football games, and then it writes stories off of that. So, for example, we just launched last week a revision to our best-selling books list, and we decided one thing that would make the books list more interesting is if we gave you some context. So not just here are the books 1 through 15 that are most popular for nonfiction paperbacks, but rather there's a new author on this list. This author has been on this list for 10 weeks. This title is the longest running ever to be on the Washington Post bestsellers list. Is that worthy of our books editor writing fewer reviews? No. On the other hand, can we craft a system that automatically tells you that story, contextualizes the information?
Software that will do that.
Yes.
And you do?
We do.
Allison, what about local and Vox? I mean, do you see local as important? And if so, how do you go after it?
It's very important, but it's not... under our view. We are a national news brand, and we don't have local offices. But we do, I mean, when we think about the Vox brand is to explain the news. And so that means there are definitely stories that come up, whether it's Charlottesville or, you know, Ferguson, where the national attention is to a local area where everyone is wondering what is happening there, what is going on, and why does this matter? And that's where Vox tries to step in and provide that level of context for people who haven't been following the story all along. Now, whether that is at a local level of a story like Ferguson, or whether it is, you know, conflict with North Korea, we tried to do the same thing either way. And you might not have been following this before, but now everyone's talking about it. It's on your Facebook feed. People have questions. And that's when we try to step back and give the context there.
Big area of interest for people in this hall, audio. You mentioned it right off the bat. You've all nodded along. Talk about your audio efforts right now and how you see them growing over time, how you see them shaped.
Absolutely. We're thrilled that we have four very successful podcasts at the moment. We are looking to do more and have plans to do a couple more coming pretty soon.
So, what are the four you have? What are the focus?
We have two roundtable discussions. The Weeds is the one I mentioned before, which is with Ezra Klein, Matt Iglesias, and Sarah Cliff, and they talk about policy details. We have a new one that just launched a few weeks ago called Worldly, which is a foreign policy roundtable discussion. And then we have the Ezra Klein Show, which is obviously Ezra Klein, interviewing folks. And then we also have I Think You're Interesting, which is our critic at large, Todd Vanderwerf, interviewing folks in the culture space with an emphasis on television.
Where do you see that going over time?
Nothing but growing. Audio is something that we are so excited about. I think probably many people in this room are familiar with a Pew survey that came out a couple years ago that people could click on an article on Facebook like six times and never know your brand. It was like absolutely terrifying to a brand that was growing completely around Facebook.
Yes.
But there is a loyalty that people have when they hear your voice, when they ride with you in the car. I mean, you all know this better than anyone. And so for our brand, we think the loyalty and the that kind of intimacy that can come through only in audio is absolutely critical going forward. And we also think it's just an incredible storytelling method.
What kind of numbers are you seeing in your audio efforts, and what do you need to make it viable?
I should have checked what I can say publicly on these things before I came today.
It's just us chickens.
Yeah, and just us chatting. We've grown dramatically. We started podcasting in January 2016, and we are, let's see, I mean, I just showed the chart the other day. It's like this. It's really, really dramatic. We're seeing millions of downloads a month, and we're really, really excited about it.
And much more to come.
Yes.
Jeremy, what about audio in the Washington Post realm?
We are also doing a number of different podcasts. So we do about a half dozen pretty successful podcasts. We were really thrilled to have a top 10 iTunes news podcast with Can He Do That, all about what presidential power is actually allowed and not allowed to do. We've had pretty great success with Presidential, which walked through the president's week by week over 45 weeks, culminating the election, where we talked about leadership styles. I think in many ways, as excited as we are about podcasts, we're even more excited about interactive audio. I'm less convinced that it's specifically the Google Home, the new Apple speaker, or any of the speakers that Amazon is creating, than it is this sort of idea that, especially if you watch children interact with these audio devices, they start to believe that any room you walk into, any car, any room in your home, any place in your work, that you ask a question, you make a request, and the room responds. That changes your relationship dramatically. It doesn't mean that every audio story you tell has to be the answer to an individual question, but it does mean that people are going to have the ability to be much more tailored to in what they want from their audio. So we are starting to think about our stories, even our text-based stories, as answers to questions people might ask. Think about it like Jeopardy. So what are the questions people might pose that you have the answer to in an individual story? That's where I really think audio is going. I think that's really the power of audio, is while you are doing other things, whether it's making coffee, getting ready in the morning, cooking, hanging out, or just being at work, our journalism can answer questions people might pose to it, but we almost never think about it that way. I think that's going to be the most crucial thing.
This is a very Amazon thing. I mean, so Alexa, what did the president say yesterday that's got people so upset? And on comes a Washington Post
audio. That's the idea.
Audio.
That's where we think it will go. And NPR, for example, I don't know so much about whether you as member affiliate stations feel this way, but NPR certainly has some huge advantages. It's practically default on the Amazon products to say, I want my morning news. Oh, it comes from NPR. So that's great. But the next step in that process is my being able to ask that question and get the right answer. Now it's a little too difficult, but it's going there.
When I ask Alexa, I mean, Amazon owns you, so it'll be the
Jeff
answer.
Does.
Okay, but it'll come.
It is a little different.
He'll want the answer to come from you because not
no.
NPR.
I mean, that's the difference. So what he will say is, yes, I believe that being on the Echo platform is very, very important. Yes, I will give you advice about what I think will work or not work, and then you pitch that to the Amazon executives, and they. no one believes that Jeff is such a softie that he's going to play favorites because he owns the one and he owns the other. It doesn't work that way. If we have a really compelling idea, we can put things on Amazon. You know, we've had some skills that we developed around the election, around the Olympics. We do a daily briefing, all of those things. But it's a relationship much like it is with Google or will be with Apple, where if the content is compelling, they'll pick us. And if they don't, then they don't.
But it'll have to be prepped so that it's got the software hooks on it to appear as the answer to your question. So will you prep everybody or just your own properties?
Well, so one of the things we are doing is we are building into the content management system that we have developed. We use mostly in-house tools at this point, which is very much a sort of if your business depends on it, build it philosophy. And we are making it much easier that as stories are produced, we can have those audio hooks just like we have social sharing built into our platform. It's not unlike what Vox does. And I know that Gannett's been thinking about it too.
Audio in your world, Maribel.
Just like Allison and Jeremy, we're very bullish. We're certainly investing a lot there. One of the things we just did, it was announced several weeks ago, was hire an investigative producer in Chicago, Robin Ammer, who will launch for us this fall the City podcast, investigative, serialized podcast on issues in the city of Chicago.
This is the one that was incubated in public broadcasting at WNYC. They didn't greenlight it. You snacked it up.
We did. And we're very excited. We're actually delighted to welcome Robin to the family and think it's a great opportunity, great
platform.
What
will it do? How will it work? I'm sorry, the city?
So Robin is based in Chicago. She will start there. She has been digging into some very specific stories, investigative stories in Chicago. The podcast will, once it launches, will be, you know, a serialized telling of those stories.
For Chicago audiences or for...
Hopefully it has a much broader audience than Chicago. I think there'll be a lot of interest in the things going on in that city. But yes, it is specific to Chicago, but something that we see, for example, launching the city in many other cities.
How much replication do you think you can do? And what distinguishes it from just any other podcast about a city or town?
Well, I think it's going to really focus on a specific issue, specific story, specific investigation, and I think that will be what's compelling about it.
Mm-hmm. So it'll be like Serial or something.
Exactly. It won't be just telling the news of Chicago any given day. It will be absolutely much more Serial-like approach.
You say you're very bullish. You're putting a lot of resources in this direction. What does that mean in Gannett's world when you're putting a lot of resources towards something?
From a product development standpoint, all the things that Jeremy is just speaking to in terms of how we think about our content management system, which is also proprietary, and making sure that we are prepared to respond to the needs of audio. All of these platforms, again, interactive audio, we absolutely see as really important. We're in conversations with the Amazons and Googles, et cetera, to make sure that our content is being created in a way that will make sense for those platforms and be able to take advantage of what we see as an incredible growth opportunity. We're investing in the skills, in our journalists. We have, a number of our journalists have created their own podcasts, both at the local level and at the national level, and we will continue to do that.
Jeremy, I hear you saying that basically you want to make everything in the post world available in an audio form. Am I wrong? And if so, how do you voice that? Is it going to be machine voiced? Alexa, what happened in Charlottesville at this corner of X and Y? Who's going to voice that? And how much will be audio available?
So some of it will be voiced by our individual journalists. Certainly people have the closest relationship with individuals telling their stories. That said, we're also trying to figure out what do we do about the rest of the stories, some of which, just by sheer volume, you know how difficult it is to produce audio. You're not going to produce, we publish something like 350, 400 stories a day. It would be a lot of effort to make all of those audio stories. So, for example, we're using Amazon's Poly technology, which is text-to-speech technology. Is it perfect? No. Is it better than not having an audio version of your stories? Probably yes. Is that what we're going to want to put in interactive audio? Not necessarily. On the other hand, if you're starting your morning commute and you're going to take the train or you're in the car and you want to queue up a few Washington Post stories, would we rather you do it that way than try to read while you drive? Yes. So until driverless cars, we're thinking about how audio can complement the text-based story.
And over time, given how the technology is advancing, what portion of your news do you anticipate will be available in an audio form ultimately?
It's a great question, but I think the goal would be for most of it. Some of the things are going to be so image-driven that it won't make sense. Some of the things will be so video or graphics-driven that it'll be difficult. But I think most of our stories, we should have some audio version, whether it's text-to-speech or human-read, eventually. And a lot of those stories, we're going to be able to single out particular passages that will be really important as answers to questions, and maybe those pieces can be human-read as well.
Heads up, I'm sure you have riveted attention right here. If you have questions, we have microphones here and here. Please approach, and we're happy to take them. While these come up, let me just ask you about metrics. And Allison, let me start with you. What are the most important metrics that you measure your success when it comes to disruption, innovation, change by?
I would say if I had to pick one, it would be the engagement metric. You know, we really are...
What do you mean by that exactly? It can mean a lot of things.
It's going to mean something different depending on the platform, but we parse those out platform by platform to look at what's the one that's proving that our content was valuable enough to someone that they chose to engage with it. They shared it, they emailed it, they whatever that is. But looking for the way to just determine when it is that someone finds a piece of content really valuable, not just they happen to come across it.
Maribel, most important metrics?
I'm all centered on engagement. Everything from your visit depth, page views per visit, scroll depth, shares, everything tied to engagement is far more important than anything else.
Jeremy?
I would agree on engagement, but specifically what we're talking most about is subscriber propensity. So if you are a subscriber, or if we believe that you have become a subscriber, that's what we really want to measure, because that direct relationship with our audience is incredibly powerful. Does that work on every platform? Of course not. It works best, primarily, honestly, only on platforms we control directly, but that's what we care about.
You mean, are you paying us?
Well, are you already paying us? Or after reading the story, do you become a subscriber? Or there's a third bucket, which is, are you behaving like someone who might become a subscriber? You're not in this given time period, but you could.
So engagement, great, but really, well, bottom line is, do we have a financial relationship?
Well, I mean, yes. But the way that we think about our subscribers are people who are our most intensely loyal people are our subscribers. So are we serving the people who really, really love and depend on our journalism? And does that in turn drive them to be essentially members in your sort of parlance? Yes.
Questions? Is there a question here?
Yes, morning.
Please.
Yeah. Thank you for this conversation. This is maybe a question first for Jeremy, just because you've been speaking about images, but really it's for any and all of you. And I'm wondering if there's a conversation happening in news and media organizations around images and journalistic integrity, because with print media, there was a sort of belief and trust that the images that we were looking at were directly associated with the stories that we were reading. And now with digital media, I don't feel that way at all. So if we're reading a story about how Donald Trump is angry at the Washington Post and we see a photo of Donald Trump scowling, there's not that same trust that image is actually associated with that story, with that press conference, what have you. And there feels like there's a certain manipulation of readers in that. You know, the image is very, very powerful and very visceral, but
that's
not necessarily
question.
Truly associated.
Let us pick it up. And are there guidelines for what image you can put with what?
Well,
news?
You know, we certainly spend a lot of time talking about the credibility of the journalism that we do, and that absolutely extends to the visual imagery that we pick. I think that runs the gamut from saying don't use generic stock imagery if you possibly can, to how is not just whether or not the image is true, but based on the perspective and the lighting conditions and other things, are you sending a message with the individual images you select? Right now, we are mostly having our photo editors drive that conversation with individual reporters. As we have shifted some of the responsibility of image selection directly to reporters and assigning editors, that has meant we had an obligation as a newsroom to make sure our most trained editors were spending time and saying, this is what I look for, these are the things to be concerned about. It includes rights management, you know, because photographers have a right to a living just as much as any other type of journalist, as well as what are the sort of inadvertent effects of the image we chose. Are we perfect about it? Not probably yet. Are we thinking about, for example, helping our editors and reporters know whether an image is fake or real? Absolutely.
But how closely to this question do you require the image be related to the news that's being conveyed? Donald Trump is angry. I got a great scowl from January. Now it's August. Do I use the scowl from January at the Washington Post?
We're trying not to. I mean, we're trying to use... if you talk about the president, there are no shortage of images.
True.
If you start to talk about these lesser figures, if you're talking about a kid who... Or a young person who appeared in the rally in Charlottesville, and then you find a Facebook photo from 3 years ago that you don't know what the context is, we should have a conversation about that. Mm-hmm. That's a very different thing than, do we have the right image from a press conference? We can find the right image from the press conference, no problem. What do we deal with these other figures who are not as regularly photographed? Those are much more difficult conversations. Those are the kind of conversations we want our reporters and editors to involve a photo editor, someone who's really an expert in that
area. Maribel, do you have strict guidelines on this?
I don't know about strict guidelines to address those, you know, narrow topics, but yes, we have our principles of ethical conduct, and part of that is making sure that we are hewing to complete transparency about when an image was taken, what the context of that image is. You know, absolutely, we'd have conversations. I don't know that there's a conscious bent toward pick the scowling image of the president, but
no,
I see.
No, but does it have to be related to the news of the day? Or, you know, there were even some images, I think, of Nazi symbols that came out with some Charlottesville stories that mm-hmm. weren't from this latest Charlottesville demo. And to this question, well, is that okay?
Well,
it's a great swastika. Let's use it here.
I think it really depends on the context. I mean, if what you're showing is that there have been other rallies that have also turned violent and they happen to include that imagery, I think contextually it's relevant and that's okay.
As long as you say what it is.
Absolutely.
Sir.
Good morning. Thanks for such a provocative discussion. Jeremy, you've spoken about the idea of embedding audience teams with your reporters, and Maribel, you talked about journalists as marketers. As agents of change and navigating the digital disruption, drill into those ideas a little bit and how you've evolved the conversation in the newsroom. So that's just not okay, but essential.
Do you mind if I start?
No, go ahead.
Jeremy? So I think there are two things. So what we do is we have an audience engagement team. We tend to organize the newsroom around the vertical subject areas. By that, I mean national, sports, style, local, foreign, finance, et cetera. In each of those groups, sometimes even in subgroups, like the politics team, for example, has a member of our audience team that sits with the politics team. They have two jobs. One, they need to be an expert in a particular platform. You know, it could be Facebook or LinkedIn or the chat messaging systems or Snapchat, et cetera. So their job is to understand an individual platform and often be the liaison to that platform and then to spread the knowledge of what that platform is capable of to everyone, especially to their colleagues on the audience team, but to the rest of the newsroom as well. Their other role, equally important, maybe more, is to think about how we are going to tell the story of the stories coming out of that vertical. So what is the strategy for a particular piece of journalism, especially for our biggest projects? We want to think about that in advance. With stories that we're telling individually that just come up every day, then how do we make sure that we're sharing them the right way? The reporters and editors are doing the first draft of the language that we would use on particular platforms, but the audience editor might get involved in helping to shape that. It might be after publication, but you can still improve the conversation. It might be what the follow-up part of the conversation is like. So these people, in theory, are shaping most, if not all, the stories that are being published, but especially looking ahead on the biggest projects.
Oh, I just have
comments.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to add. And when Vox launched, we talked a lot about the importance of creating a social newsroom. And the idea was that every single person in the newsroom had to care about social, which is very similar to what you were talking about before. But we did that by every single staff meeting on a Friday, which was like 30 people at that point, crammed into a room. And every single week, I was pointing out the best social headlines, the best social images, and the results that it had. And people get competitive. They get excited about wanting to see their story do well. And we did that for so long. Now now that we're about 100, we do it more at the team level and then in a monthly staff meeting. But for the beginning, you know, we spent a long time on the exact same tips over and over and over again and showing the results.
Maribel, thoughts
on
promoting
that? Along those same lines, I mean, some real tactical things. We have invested in our business intelligence team. We have analysis. We have our tools that we use, you know, Chartbeat and Omniture and other things. But we've developed proprietary analytical tools around that surface in real time for all of our journalists these are the stories that are working, these are the kinds of headlines that are working, these are, you know, on different social platforms, this stuff's working, that's not, and making adjustments. And so we've invested in a lot of those tactics and tools for our journalists, but we've also assigned, you know, resource to that. So we have analysts who sit in our newsrooms and are providing that kind of real-time marrying up the metrics with the strategy and helping to inform, you know, our news report, frankly.
They're not flying blind.
They're not, no.
Question right here. Corey.
You're all moving into audio. What is your interest level in doing that yourself or, say, relying on organizations that already have that expertise?
We're very interested. We're very interested in partnerships. The Vox Media Podcast Network actually is developing and growing in big ways and bringing in new partnerships all the time. So we're really interested in that.
Yeah, same here. Absolutely.
We've talked to people in the room about partnering. I think it's absolutely. You guys have a lot of expertise. We are learning painfully many of the lessons that you probably learned as an intern. So, you know, we have a lot of catch up to do, but. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think partnerships are a key part.
But you started out saying you want to own it. You don't want to be renting.
Maybe
it was you, Maribel. You don't want to be renting presence elsewhere, Facebook, Google.
Well, that's a little bit different, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, the idea that we do this all the time in many forms, but the idea that we would partner with, you know, great creators of audio content to do something jointly and mm-hmm. and to distribute that content.
Locally, nationally,
absolutely. I think that's very different.
I think the people in this room, the people on the stage, we're less competitors now than we have ever been before. That the opportunity to collaborate and partner, I mean, it's not that we have to compete with Google and Facebook, but certainly it's not as if our audiences have said, oh, if I get my news from Gannett, I would never look at the Washington Post. That's not how it works. So if we have an opportunity to take our most valuable people in our newsroom, in our company, our reporters, and have them on your air or have them produced with your expertise, that's very valuable to us.
Or vice versa?
Or vice versa.
Absolutely.
One more? Is this a question?
Okay. Sorry. Hi. So the session is about digital disruption, and there's been a lot of conversation about how it's disrupted your businesses. And all of your businesses are about the text, the written word, for the most part. Two of your businesses, legacy newspaper, but also text, written word. So you're all very smart. I would like to hear each of you, if you could give a recommendation to how radio programs and stations could think about digital disruption. Because when you have spoken about audio, it's mostly been about podcasts. But radio shows are more than just podcasts. So just curious of recommendations or pointers.
Okay, so work it from the other side. If you were in the radio / audio, because it's podcast too, if you were coming from that side, how would you approach this moment of disruption? Maribel?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I know, and you started the conversation in a little bit different way this morning. You know, I think all of us certainly, I mean, there's digital disruption. The disruption is really in the fragmentation of content and all the distribution platforms and all the ways that you can create content from text to audio to video to, you know, across social platforms. The true disruption in my mind right now for all of us is really not about technology and not about digital at all. And it's about what you first started talking about, Tom, which is, you know, that we're living in a truly post-truth world. And so what can we all as inherently local news mediums with relationships with our communities, with the people we serve, how do we leverage that across all of these platforms to break past, to earn back trust, mm-hmm. to regain credibility, to you know, get to a place where we can overcome this notion that facts are just speed bumps on the path to whatever convictions you already have. I think that is the biggest thing. I mean, we can talk, we can share ideas about, you know, different strategies for, you know, how to distribute our content, how to create different storytelling platforms all day long. But at the end of the day, that is the greatest disruption we're all facing right now, and that's what we need to get really smart about.
Jeremy, look at it from the audio / even radio side. You know, if you were coming from that side, how would you look at this moment?
I think when you talk about, first, I don't believe radio is going away. I do think that there are lots of other ways that people will consume your news and information if you're doing your jobs right, but I think radio will still be there. If I were to relate the sort of radio versus digital audio and other digital forms, pre-Bezos acquisition, something like 60% of everything that went into the paper made it onto digital platforms for the Post. Now, something like 40% of all the stories we generate make it into the newspaper. I think that has to be closer to the mix for radio. I don't know enough to know. You may already say, we're already there. But I think if everything that you want to publish on any platform is going into radio, you're probably missing an opportunity. That you have to be able to say, we are going to create compelling radio for the people who want to receive our journalism that way, but we also are going to acknowledge that there are so many other platforms that we're going to publish lots of things that never make it into the radio, and that's okay. I'm at a disadvantage because I'm not in your newsrooms, and so I don't know if you're there already, but I think that is the most critical thing that happened to us that feels like a parallel to what would be happening in your newsrooms, is that you don't want to do sub-quality radio. No one thinks that that's a good idea. But if that still commands most of the attention of your newsroom, it's going to be problematic any more than we want to create a great newspaper, but that can't be the main focus of what we do.
A bunch of people are looking beyond that, but still, that's great. And our time is short, but
sure.
Your thought, Allison?
I would just say, as coming from a brand that was maybe seen as a disruptor, we weren't a print newspaper. We started digital first. I think it would have been really easy to focus on our digital aspect as what defined us. You know, we were founded by bloggers. We could have easily thought of our Twitter handle is actually vox.com. We could have really thought of the website as what we are. But instead, we thought about what we were as what our brand mission was, and that was to explain the news. And that has allowed us to quickly move into other platforms and other places and know how to be Vox there. And so what I would do is I would go back to your shows, back to your newsrooms, and discuss what are you not in terms of being a radio show or a platform that you're on, but what is the mission to the audience, and then have that guide how you show up in other places.
This has been riveting, useful, challenging, inspirational, and very real. Allison, Jeremy, Maribel, thank you very much to all three of you for being with us this morning.
Thank you
very much for joining us. Thank you. Really terrific.
Thanks for listening to my conversation at PRPD, the Public Radio Content Conference in Washington, about digital disruption of news and media with Jeremy Gilbert of The Washington Post, Matt Thompson of TheAtlantic.com, Allison Rocky at Vox, and Maribel Perez Wadsworth, Senior Vice President and Chief Transformation Officer at Gannett. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this was a special edition of On Point. You can get On Point wherever you get your podcasts or listen weekdays to On Point on your local NPR station. Join us.